Well, today I have to tackle a little bit Heraclitus of Ephesus, and I'm shivering. Because he is such a forbidding figure. He wrote one book, and what we have left of this book are, so to speak, I mean, pieces taken out of other people's texts. And we are first to ask the question, how comes that so little is left? Heraclitus was a strange Greek. He did not believe in freedom, which is very rare in Greece. He was a tyrant himself, a tyrannical nature. We cannot approach him with love. He is very little lovable, not at all. He is a hard, cool, forbidding figure. That's how he conducted his life. He made himself hated by everybody, and he hated everybody. Why was he forced to do that? He had a vision of the world, a metaphysical vision, which became much, much later very fruitful for the whole development of science and philosophic science in Europe. The Greeks themselves not only killed him, his co-citizens in Ephesus, they drove him into the temple of Diana, where he had to starve. Nobody could kill him in that district, but nobody would bring him food. And there he was finally ending how he had begun his life, in complete isolation, detached from everybody and everything. He was really throwing a cold eye on things and the world and his co-human beings. It's natural enough that very few Greek philosophers followed him. They called him the dark one, the obscure one. And we have seen, since he was resurrected in the 19th century, that he is by no means dark, that he is by no means obscure. They were afraid of him. He created, like all Greeks, a view of the cosmos, the ordered universe, but he did it in such a way that there was not a bit of poetry in it, not a bit of love in it, not a bit of consistency in it. And the Greeks just hated that view. That's why they neglected him, and by neglect, this tremendous house that he has built has fallen down, and we are left with those pieces. We could perhaps say that Anaxagoras is the only one, but he had to replace the term logos by the term nous, and that could mean much more, so much more that even Socrates started to study Anaxagoras and then left him. All the others were his enemies. This was a situation in Greece at his time, 6th century, that was ruled by Homer. And then this man turns up and offends everybody because he sets straight against poetry. Poetry had created the first world view of the cosmos for the Greeks. It was a nice cosmos, three compartments, gods, men, and nature, clearly divided. And if there wasn't any peace in the world, there could be peace in the cosmos in the long run. It was a very optimistic view. Then a man turns up who hates not only Homer. I said he hated all men. He hated Homer especially. There's no other Greek, Xenocrates and Plato later, will doubtlessly attack Homer because of his theological views. They didn't want the gods so immoral as they thought they were in Homer's view. That is a sideline and really unimportant question. Heraclitus speaks about Homer in terms that would have insulted. Homer was the god of the Greeks. Everybody was educated by Homer. They loved him. Old philosophers much, much later will still say, like Socrates, the youngsters love lyrical poetry. When they grow men, they love dramatic poetry and tragedy. But we, the oldsters, we still turn back to Homer and Hesiod because there is so much more thought in them. Heraclitus rejected that absolutely. He is speaking mockingly about Hesiod and Homer. Look at them, those heroes of the Greeks, he says. They didn't even know that all is one and they call them wise. What he did was to put against Homer the first great work, we have only the leftovers, of Greek prose. Poetry confronted by prose. He was such a sober man, and he wanted to look at the world scientifically, and so he had to hate poetry. He did not only hate the myth, he was one of the greatest smashers of mythical thinking that ever lived. Listen to him when he says, there they go, those drunkards, and celebrate Dionysus, the god of life, they think, and they don't know that Dionysus and Hades, the god of death, are one. They are celebrating their bloody festivals, he says. They believe in demons. There are no demons in the world. He is one of the greatest smashers of myths. Let's take a sober look at it, so to speak. He says, he invented Greek prose. Think him as the Greeks did still, dark, obscure. He invented a kind of prose that is even greater in the leftovers than the other great Greek prose written by Thucydides. It is so cold, so hard, it is almost to be called, though he was not a Spartan, it's called, to be called laconic. Statement after statement, apparently well joined in the beginning, but all cold statements like Greek marble, a wonderful, a masterful prose, even in the little pieces we have left. In that sense, his work is like a Greek temple. If it has fallen down and completely destroyed, and we have a few left over, then we see the style is going through, and Heraclitus is not dark, but we can reconstruct him to a certain degree because all the main elements are still left. Not only that he hated myths, he hated what he considered to be the continuous of myths, namely poets. For him, those are old wives' tales that they tell each other and tell the people. And he wanted the truth and nothing but the truth. And for that, he led his life in that way. It is the model of the most detached from everything, from human beings, from gods, from everything, the most detached intellectual that has ever lived. If we consider a modern scientist who tries to be objective and lives an objective and detached life because he has to, it's nothing against Heraclitus. Here a fanatism of detachment becomes visible, which paves the way for this wonderful, paves the way metaphysically for the existence of this whole line of scientists, of this great capability of man. It is a partly capability only, it should be only partly. Heraclitus was it completely. He is a victim, so to speak, of his vision. The capability of scientific thinking requires that we do so we cannot our utmost to be as objective and as detached from the object as possible. As far as it is in the human mind, Heraclitus is almost a superman by achieving that perfectly. For an ideal, he has a vision of the cosmos and he has to present this vision. He calls everybody a dumbhead, an idiot, and somebody who nobody understands him, and he doesn't even want to talk in the end anymore. He leaves this book and dies. The most arrogant, intellectually arrogant figure I have ever seen in all of world history, and the most brave, because he had a new vision and he denied everything else, any right of anybody to talk with him. He wrote, "I do not write for dumbheads. May they break their heads." I hear an echo. 19th century Nietzsche. Zarathustra says, "I do not write for idiots. People who cannot try to understand me shall better be blinded by my wisdom." An aristocratic, a haughty position, it stems from Heraclitus. We can very well, though we have only a few political sayings left, conclude that his original conflict with his co-citizens was that he was logically obliged to erect a tyranny. He was an anti-democrat, as we have never seen anybody else in Greece being an anti-democrat, out of principle, because he only knew what is right, he only knew the truth, and nobody else. And let them please bow down and obey him. He was not a politician, but at that time they all were politicians. He was mixed up in politics, and that is the root of the hatred against him. He withdrew from politics because he had more to say. The cosmos of Homer and the cosmos of all the other Greek thinkers, however they explain it, if the principle of the cosmos, the well-ordered universe, is finally with Anaxagoras the nous, or it is with Aristotle the unmoved mover, whatever principle they find, they move away from the principle that Heraclitus presented, and that principle is the logos. We today know what we owe to him. We owe to him really the invention, so to speak, of a principle which makes scientific research and scientific mind possible. There wasn't any before. Thales was earlier. He started science, so to speak, by an hypothesis, saying all is water. Then Anaximenes says all is air. They were looking really soberly at the world and without any belief. They wanted to find out the basic material. Then comes Heraclitus and says fire. And he doesn't mean that the whole world is fire. He doesn't mean the element, because he tells us that fire will change into water, water will change into fire, and earth will change into fire and water, and we see a vision of a possibility of interchanging elements. We have discovered much more elements in the meantime. The alchemists have used Heraclitus, so to speak, for a long time. They wanted to make gold. Okay, today we can make gold. It's only too costly. Since we have atomic science, nuclear science, we can change indeed every element that exists in matter into the other. We only have to rearrange the atoms. That is a far look ahead when he talked about the interchangeability of the elements. What did he mean by fire? Fire was a symbol for him, the symbol of process. Something is going on. Something is changing, especially visible in fire. This change he was after. He paints a world that is in constant, permanent change. The unity of opposites, strife, a very wild cosmos indeed. His main principle is the Logos. Now it's a far way till finally in Christianity there will appear the incarnated Logos, which is supposed to be Christ. The Logos of Heraclitus has nothing whatsoever to do with it. It isn't Jehovah either. He is speaking cold-bloodedly about this topic, which we called here the growing God consciousness of man. He is only concerned with the growing world consciousness of man. Here he follows Homer without knowing it, because for Homer, the cosmos was God. The gods were only in the cosmos. The cosmos itself and its laws, namely Moira, fate, necessity, where the real God. Heraclitus, he might hate the idea, followed Homer in that. His Logos is a principle, and it is beyond the world, and it works into the world. This principle is, so to speak, for us, an incarnation, if you look back, of his discovery of one great fact, and he is the first to discover that, namely the irresistibility of the human intellect. If he says Logos, I would say intellect. Because he describes as his Logos only the intellect. There's nothing else. There's not a drop of blood of the heart in his whole writings. There is no other world but the intellectual world that can be conceived by a strict intellectual man who applies no other laws and has no other concerns than the strict necessity of happenings. Here, this metaphysician paves really the way for science. If a scientist can afford to be interested in nothing but the how it happens, can neglect the what and does not answer the why, then he can indeed proceed, and he can very well proceed. Heraclitus established that line. He says, if you listen to the Logos, if you listen not to me, but to the Logos, the law of necessity, I translate, the necessary law. There's nothing in the world that happens accidentally. The world can be understood completely if we understand its law. It is the first great idea of the possibilities of natural law. Every scientist will have to accept, up to our most modern ones, that metaphysical assumption that we can know only by the logical organization of natural laws and human laws. The sociologists, he paved the way. He is not a scientist himself. He's not very much interested. He neglects direct knowledge. He wants to make knowledge possible, and nothing but knowledge. He isn't talking about wisdom that doesn't exist for him, as some, an old wife's tale. He doesn't listen to beauty as an old wife's tale. He wants to have this one ironclad law of necessity. We can explain everything. The dream of science. Here the dream starts. We can explain everything with the help of the Logos. So the Logos is his God, so to speak, but what a God is that? He says you can call it Zeus or the Logos, it doesn't care. Of all the Greek gods, he recognizes only Zeus, and him he uses as a pseudonym for his Logos. It means, pantheistically speaking, that he really believes the world is full of spirit, of intellect. Everything is ruled by the absolute intellect, which we cannot achieve, but our own intellect is infinitely expanding and can expand itself. It is self-increasing. He draws a sharp line. The unity, all is one, is given in the idea that the Logos, the absolute Logos, who rules the world, being outside the world, he rules, Zeus rules the world by the thunderbolt, he says. He is sending lightnings into the world and mixes it up. But the world itself partakes in the Logos to different degrees. The degrees are important. The Logos that rules nature, so to speak, let me repeat. If we translate it with spirit, intellect, Geist, then he means the world is through and through spiritual. Spirit works in everything, in the lowest thing, leave alone in man. And it is absolute in God, or what he calls a God. It is a view of a dualistic nature which has been made a monistic one by putting the two together. That means matter and spirit. He sees it at one. Spirit is working in matter and it is ruling matter. Where did we ever hear that? I heard it last in the 19th century, when Hegel wrote his philosophy, and Hegel called very dubiously his God, whom he wanted to be the Hebrew God and the Christian God, he called him the world spirit. The world spirit works in the world, works himself through all the world. He learned all that from Heraclitus. Because the idea of the Logos, as Heraclitus presents it to us, is the idea of the world spirit already. And the world spirit in permanent action. Might be that the Greeks, aside from his hating Homer, and they couldn't use him, not understanding his prose, might be that they also did not like a permanently disturbed cosmos. He is the only Greek who, so to speak, says in a very modern way, the cosmos is nothing but a rounded phenomenon of infinite action. It's a dynamic cosmos. It is a bundle of energies that change into each other. Very modern, isn't it? Because it is the modern view. That is the 5th century BC, where he had that vision. He develops from there a strict logical continuity. His cosmos is indeed closed. We have an idea of the infinite cosmos or infinite universe. Universe is different from cosmos. Universe was the phenomenon. Cosmos means a well-ordered one. And if you have the well-ordered cosmos, then you have to give account of the order in it. That is the idea of Heraclitus. He gives account of the order. Nothing happens accidentally. No demons exist. You just have to understand the one law that drives everything, and that is the law of the unity of opposites. The world is ruled by fire, is ruled by movement, is ruled by dynamics, and the law of dynamics is that every time new strife will break out, war makes kings, makes gods, he says mockingly. Gods are made by wars, huh? He is only too right. He doesn't mean Zeus. The all-powerful principle he believes in. He just doesn't know what it is. He cannot explain the absolute. He avoids that carefully. But he indicates that in every phenomenon he watches, he was a tremendous observer, withdrawn and always observing. And he found a unity in all things which he thought he can preach to us. And that unity is the logicality of every happening in the world. That means the spirit is in everything. And nothing can be accidental. Nothing can be taken out of context. It is an eternal flux. Flux. Yes, flux. And that means process. Since Hegel, 19th century, all our scientists and all our philosophers have started to think in terms of process. It came from him. He was the first to envision the world, what a vision it is, to be in constant change and logical change, process that leads to something. And he asks us to inquire into it, because we have also this spirit in ourselves. And he promises us, so to speak, if you start, I speak now in my words, if you start scientific research earnestly and judge all phenomena merely scientifically, then you will succeed, because I guarantee you, so to speak, that your logos, the amount of spirit that is in you, is very different from the logos in all other things, because you can travel over land and sea any way. You will never, never understand the logos of the human soul. So deep is its logos. He means mind when he says soul. He doesn't even have an idea what is meant by soul. He really means intellect. And the logos that rules our intellect, he describes as an infinite logos. Infinite not eternal, but infinite, permanently growing, because he says, and that is one of his so-called darkest sayings, it is self-increasing. That means the logos of man, the logos that rules the human intellect, is self-increasing. Isn't it? Look at the development of the sciences. Every day something new, every day something added. Almost every 4 weeks a new science made possible. The knowledge of man is permanently growing. Indeed, he was right. He is only concerned with that part of our mind, so to speak, which is assembling knowledge, strict logical knowledge. And this indeed is growing. Unfortunately, the other parts of our mind are not growing that fast. The intellect has outrun us and science has been triumphant. Because, or thanks to Heraclitus, in a way. The Greeks didn't take him up, and then something very strange happened. Those few leftovers are suddenly becoming popular at a time when philosophers become scientifically inclined. You read the whole system of Spinoza, it is nothing but a changed system of Heraclitus. Only that in his substance, both are united, spirit and matter, when they are in Heraclitus working through each other. But the system, the idea, Deus vive natura, and that means, as the theologian said, he is an atheist, he means natura, nature is God. Indeed he meant it. He did not separate God from nature either, meaning from the world. And that made the strange and strict logicality of his system. Nothing can be said against it, once you have accepted the assumption. From then on, Descartes before Spinoza, of course, then Spinoza, Leibniz to a certain degree, and suddenly Heraclitus is resurrected in the 19th century, and Hegel, Nietzsche, Marx all become fanatical Heraclitians. This is some wonder, that is some miracle, how leftovers of one work can last that long and then become most modern. They needed process thinking. Hegel especially established process thinking. Who is better to go back to in order to establish thinking in terms of process? They meant evolution, fine. That's another thing. Heraclitus wouldn't have agreed to that, because he didn't have any idea of evolution, as well as he didn't have any idea of an infinite universe, not at all. They applied his terms in their way. And they wanted to have an aim, Hegel, and like Darwin, evolution, that means the whole process leads to something. In Heraclitus, the whole process of the cosmos leads to absolutely nothing. Except more force, more development of energy, more quarrel, more strife, and that seemed to have been his big joy. Strangely enough, a non-scientific philosopher draws the conclusion, and that is Friedrich Nietzsche. When he talks about Dionysus, who is the world, and about his Superman, then he is a strict Heraclitian. He draws only conclusions. The growing consciousness of the world, the growing world itself, as Heraclitus figures it. That is the only aim. There is no other aim. That makes the whole thing finally a little bit grotesque. If he buttonholed him like Socrates would and said, "Oh, Heraclitus, you know, you say you know what truth is. Will you please explain it to me? You have gotten hold of an absolute principle. I, dumbhead that I am, I don't know anything about absolute principles. How can you want to create a system of deduction from that absolute principle which you do not have, which is only your dream?" And in his spirit we would ask him, "Yes, Heraclitus, that's all very nice. You have paved the way for science. You wanted to answer only the question, how do things happen? And you discovered certain laws, the laws of the unity of opposites, the laws of strife. You discovered the laws of dynamics, the laws of permanent, eternal change or infinite change. But you didn't answer one question. You tried to answer the question, what? And that you answered also very correctly, because you said different elements, what that is, the essence of it, they change into each other. So perfect answer, we found it was true. But you didn't answer us the question, why? And you have cursed all science and all the scientific striving of men, that they would never be able to answer the question, why? It is the question that asks for an explanation of what for, why, what is the meaning of it. The world can be full of sense, and what Heraclitus describes is makes perfect sense, but there is no meaning to it. It leads nowhere. It leads only to the enlargement of itself, enlargement of knowledge. We can have infinite knowledge, we know that today. A few generations later they will laugh at us and our knowledge. We know, we are sure of that, because they have so much more than. In order to answer the question why, we must try to put a meaning into the world, not only logic. Logic makes only sense. Logic has no meaning. Logic is nothing but the capability of men to create, to relate facts to each other in a straight line, to criticize those facts, to bring them into order. That was the thing Heraclitus was mainly interested in. The cosmos must be ordered. The principle of order must be found, and that is the logos. But where are human beings? Are human beings merely objects or that have an increased logos, so to speak, and a self-increasing logos even, or are they somehow also irrational? This makes for making a living, but make for making a life. It is in that sense a strict metaphysics of science. He is not interested in anything but the rays, the infinite rays of knowledge, as far as he can go. When he presents us his logos as God, which he does in a very dubious remark, you may call him logos or may call him Zeus, he doesn't. It's an agnostic statement. But when he tries to speak about this principle as God, then he answers the question, why? Why is all this going on? Why is this movement? Why is those endless changes? And he answered, Zeus is like the world child. World child. Didn't we hear it again? This British Nietzsche. Dionysus is like the world child. Or this Hegel. He is like the world spirit. Zeus is the world child. He's playing. That is the answer to the question why. He is playing for his amusement. No other reason, no account, no meaning whatsoever is required, because we are supposed, that is the greatness of Heraclitus, to enjoy this permanent increase of knowledge, even to enjoy strife. Strange echo. Friedrich Nietzsche, who in a way understood him perfectly, without saying so. What he wrote directly about him is only in honoring him, saying he's one of the greatest Greek philosophers, it is that and that and that and that. He did not fully recognize him for the very simple reason that he was stealing from him. That is very often the case with philosophers. Philosophers are unreliable, you know. They have read something, understood something by somebody else, and they give it another form and add something of their own. Say, my idea, my idea, my idea. The scientist is never permitted to do that. They would all catch him as a charlatan. But the philosophers can afford that, apparently. He said, as if he had wanted to accomplish the perfect Heraclitus, the meaning of existence, the meaning of life, the meaning of all things in the world is the will to power. And that is also already Heraclitus. Effect, this has that effect, that has that effect. What is stronger wins, what is weaker loses, you know, it's all inhuman. It is merely objective observation of what really happens. Nietzsche gives us a meaning. He says it's a will to power. And you better get as much power as you can. And science is glorious because science is power. So Nietzsche was not a scientist, but he was the prophet of modern science by saying, measure it only in amounts of power. How does it work? Oh, you hear all the American new philosophers speak, the pragmatists. How does it work? Main thing does work. How does it work? All the functionalists. And all the people who only say it is how it works, and the criteria must be this kind of working. Operative, it must be operative thinking. That's all scientific talk. And it is very good. Step by step, they enlarge and enlarge, and all those things are valuable. Metaphysically, the last one who encourages them as much as Heraclitus had in the start encouraged scientists is Nietzsche by saying, go ahead, you will win more power. The will to power is the god of the world, and the will to power he calls Dionysos, which is very mistakenly, but nevertheless, he is the last and perhaps the most consequential Heraclitian which we have seen. That far, via Hegel and Marx, Marx is no different, he also has the same idea. Everything that counts is power. And we talk only in terms of power in social sciences. That far-reaching, the influence of this man has been. He is the first metaphysician who really disregards everything else except what can be inquired into by strictly scientific methods. With him and with others start the two metaphysical trends which have ruled the West. The one leads from him to Spinoza, to Hegel, where they both will cross, and finally to Nietzsche and Marx. The other one, the other metaphysics, the religious one, leads from the Hebrew prophets via Christianity up to the strictest theology and more theology and more knowledge about God, what do they have in common? Why does the scientific pursuit, which starts after Heraclitus, have so much sympathy to the religious one? I mean the modern religious one, the logical religious one, Hebrew and Christian. Both have a strange ideal, and it is the ideal of a scientist. It is the one wants to find out about God. They want to know God. And they say, we believe in revelation, God is revealing himself. Okay, that's the belief. But they want to know him. They want to know his will. They want to follow his will. They want to know in absolute. And the scientific metaphysics want also to know an absolute. And that absolute is called Torn Being. All that is, the whole of being, can be explained metaphysically as ontology. So theology and ontology are sisters under the skin. They both claim to know that it is possible to know an absolute, either an absolute principle, which will be called later by the envious theologians, or that Pascal, for instance, from a theological point of view, not the God of the philosophers, the God of Jacob, Abraham, and Israel, and Abraham. A living God, because the God of Heraclitus, as little as the God of Spinoza, are alive. You cannot establish any sympathy or human relation to those ideals of God, certainly not. One couldn't pray to the Logos, one must follow the Logos. One couldn't pray to them, it would be no use. There's no humanity in it, and there's no human relation possible. So both have in common the Hebrews, who have first established that idea of the absolute transcendent God and have established a science which they call theology. That means the growing knowledge of God, the metaphysical proposition, metaphysical assumption, and the other one, the principle which rules all. Aristotle will talk in the most dubious way about it by saying God is the unmoved mover. That means the principle of the unmoved mover, which is a contradiction, is made God, is also called God. Here both tendencies cross. They will part again. We will have a clear development of religious metaphysics and a clear development of scientific metaphysics. And finally, both are very much reconciled today, because the theologians will say, oh, scientists are so useful, and we must live together with them in a society. And they have become also functionaries of society too. They don't know, they don't talk about God anymore. They talk about many, many other things, but not about God. If you ask one of them, I mean even a serious one, like Paul Tillich, I discussed it often with him, but Paul, don't make competition to me. When you talk about symbols and ideas, and this is all symbolic and this is all ideas, I am competent. That I am doing. Of you, I expect that you believe in God. Oh no. You cannot accomplish it, so to speak. Nevertheless, the methods we were talking in the last lecture rather largely about possibilities of uniting methods. It is a very good attempt of the sciences that they want to unite in a way, and that they want to find common methods. They are on their way, and I wish them all the luck in the world. As to metaphysics, I see a strange identity of method in explaining divinity and gods in a theological way, that the if that is so, then this is so, as if this were all reality. And in the method of science, this is no accident. The scientists, when they came up in the Renaissance and wanted to create really science, that was the second attempt after the Greeks, and then in the Baroque time, you know, and so they said, okay, we are the new ones, we are absolutely new, we have an entirely new approach to the world, scientific approach, and nobody answers them from the theologians. But your methods you use have been created by us, haven't they? We were the first rationalists. We developed your logic. They didn't develop their mathematics, but their logic they developed. When Descartes was standing up against the medieval philosophers, he did not know how many of their arguments he used, because he had studied theology. And theology is an abstract science, has only one assumption: you have to accept God. If that is like mathematics, if you accept those few assumptions, here is the mathematical system. If you accept the other few assumptions, here is another mathematical system. Closed in itself, completely logical, indestructible, it's all true. The model of that is theology. If you assume the assumption of God, everything follows. And we can prove it to you scientifically, so to speak. So theological metaphysics and scientific metaphysics. Metaphysics, not science itself. Every scientist who refrains from being superstitious and make an absolute assumption is welcome. But the scientists who say we know an absolute, like Karl Marx, and so on, and go from there and deduct from there, they have contributed only to the superstition of our time, as well as the theologians have contributed to the superstition of our time and of our life situation. So we have, in order to, when we found them twins, and they are almost Siamese twins, much as they quarreled. There were big quarrels. Look at Galileo, between science and religion. They killed each other like twins. They use the same kind of argumentation for different purposes. Well, fortunately, science survived, and theology is very much down now. So we have to help theology a little bit and praise it a little bit, because it has become such a dwarf. In order to find it, we have to turn to that not overall or highest human capacity, but to a kind of clearing station between all the faculties we have been talking about: art, science, religion, and we will talk about politics too. There's a little clearing station between them, which is called philosophy. It is the only occupation of man, or the only creative capability. It's very small, because it's based on man's freedom. And man's freedom is unfortunately very small, but it is there, and it is the most important part. If we turn to philosophy proper, that does not mean that we take up those philosophers who have been metaphysicians of science or metaphysicians of religion and so on. I rule them all out. Because the philosopher has one obligation, if he wants to be a true philosopher, They are very, very rare. He has to forfeit every right to make a general empty speculation, to assume that he knows an absolute. The scientist is perhaps entitled to do that, not knowing an absolute. He makes an hypothesis. Hypothesis he uses as long as he can use it. As if it delivers results, fine. If it doesn't deliver results, he picks another one. That's fine. But metaphysical assumptions is a different thing. And to cure somebody, except in art, where metaphysical assumptions are beautiful, but in the other fields, to cure people from making rash and easy overall generalizations and metaphysical assumptions, there's only one help. And that help is strict critical philosophy. We demask those people who are dreamers. So we turn to Socrates. I will So we turn to Socrates. I will first only say that we have in philosophy, development of philosophy of the West, we have called in the Middle Ages and later Aristotle the philosopher. Thomas Aquinas quotes Aristotle all this as the philosopher says. The Bible says and the philosopher says. They have later called Plato the philosopher. Well, I take up Socrates as the philosopher. There's nobody on my side except one man, and his name is Plato. Plato was thinking that Socrates was the philosopher, namely the model of a philosopher. And I trust Plato a little bit. He is still more clever than we are, though I heard Dewey before he died say, those are all the old superstitions of Plato. We are living in the 20th century and you have no idea. Okay, he thought himself cleverer than Plato. Nobody is cleverer than Plato. Plato is one of the most astonishing minds that ever appeared on earth. He's like Shakespeare, like Homer. He's inexhaustible. He is as well, he's almost a monster. I mean a beautiful monster. He has scientific gifts, he is a scientist, he is a poet, he has poetic gifts, and he has philosophic gifts and metaphysical gifts. He has all in one. And we can learn from him, because he's the only one who has knowledge about it, about the figure of Socrates. Socrates himself was very different from Plato. He was not such a rich mind. He couldn't do everything as Plato could. He could almost do everything. Socrates did only one thing. He turned away from any kind of occupation except one. To stay in the city and to inquire into human beings and into himself, because he was only interested in human beings. And from then on, what we can call in a pure way philosophy started. According to the inscription on the Temple of Delphi, know thyself. And that is the occupation of philosophy, which also tries to answer the question, why? And it is the only instance where we can ask, why? What is the meaning? What for? The teleological question, which nobody else can answer, and no other capacity can answer.